Vice Chair Joe Green, Representative Mulder, Representative Sitton, Representative Porter, and gosh, I just about added you to our committee here.
Joe was talking about adopting me, and
we could go along with that.
We could go along with that.
We're going to take up House Bill 506, 497, Senate Bill 212, which is procurement bill, and looking again at House Bill 487, which the sponsor has now modified and back to us. And we are not going to take up alcohol tobacco tax bill for some reason. With that, we have before a sponsor substitute for House Bill number 487. And is that the first one? No.
We got 506.
Oh, all right. It was the top one, though.
I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. I didn't look at that pile.
Committee substitute for House Bill number 506, Hess. And we have the co-chair of Hess, Representative Bundy. Welcome, sir.
Thank you, sir. And might I comment on what a distinguished, handsome, well-dressed, well-fought,
agreeable
committee this is. I knew there was one.
We'll table this right now.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Is that bad?
Go right ahead.
What you have is a bill that has been introduced by request of the Post-Secondary Education Committee regarding student loans. In years gone by, student loans have been run on less than a business-like fashion, and as we're in a situation where the state requires that we do deal with all state business in business-like fashion, and it's important that the student loan be encouraged and allowed to run in a more business-like fashion that will allow the student loan to continue, because as you're well aware, it's not no longer funded out of general funds, and I'm concerned that if it goes back that requires a large general fund subsidy, that it may no longer exist. Well, having said all that, in order to establish this business-like atmosphere and to be fair to students, to not only allow future loans but present loans to be fair, this bill allows six different options or changes to the student loan program. First, and probably most interesting interest to the current students, is a variable interest rate. In order to get money for the student loan program, the Post-Secondary Commission must bond. Current interest rate is at 8%. What this would allow is that the interest rate would be pegged to the cost of bonding, the cost of money. This would allow the current interest rate to be reduced some. The other side of the coin is that in the event that the cost of money goes up, then the students would also bear that brunt. But each loan is figured each year, so that amount of interest is available, so they don't start out at in their freshman year and then in their senior year suddenly face 20% interest or whatever. They do have some options. There's a restriction for eligibility after you've had a loan written off due to a bad debt. Obviously, if someone wasn't able to make it once, we shouldn't be entertaining their loan again in the near future. A facility to guarantee wages for those who are in default. And I might add that the commission is doing a much better job of collecting bad loans than we were in the past. An interesting new proviso is the fourth one, in which allows the denial of state licenses if someone's in default of their loan. And that is if you have license to practice some profession in the state and you're in default. And those are the most egregious level of default to me, as someone who's making perhaps a six-figure salary and is not repaying the student loan, so that future students' loans are in jeopardy. This also provides for denial of state warrants. If you're doing business with the state and you are in default, you don't get paid until you bring your loan current. And then another item number six, which is a, also an asset to students, and allow a proviso for refinancing loans when someone's circumstances change or they have multiple loans. They might be able to consolidate and refinance. The idea is both a carrot and a stick here. We want the carrot to make the loans a little more flexible for the students and encourage them to stay out of default, and, of course, the stick if they choose to go into default. So I would like to acknowledge the presence of Mr. McCormick, the Executive Director of the Post-Secondary Ed Commission, and certainly far more an authority on student loan program than I. He'd be available for questions, and may I make myself available now for questions.
Thank you, Representative Bundy. Are there any questions of the committee at this time? We'll go ahead and hear the rest of the testimony then, and if there are additional questions. Are you going to be around for a while, Con? Are you going to go up?
I will be here for a few minutes.
Okay, you might want to, in case there are some questions, come up. For the record, Representative Williams has joined us. All right. Why don't we ask Mr. McCormick, did you wish to testify, Joe? All right. Would you like to come up, please?
Mm-hmm. Chairman Hudson, members of the committee, I just want to give you a brief background of the purpose of this bill. This bill has four purposes in terms of the administration of the Alaska Student Loan Program. Number one, we want to enhance the repayment terms for students. We want to update the ability of the students to repay the loans in two ways. As Representative Bundy mentioned, one way is to go to a variable rate of interest in which we could ensure that students would have the lowest rate at any given point in time out in the future, whereas we currently operate under a fixed rate of 8%. And depending on the cost of money, that may be a high rate or a low rate. Secondly, we would enhance their ability to repay these loans by providing a consolidation program. Many Alaska students have borrowed money under the program at a 5% loan and then years later borrowed under an 8% loan. They have multiple loans with multiple provisions that they have to keep track of individually now. The consolidation part of that program would provide opportunity to collapse all of those separate loans into one new loan. Secondly, we want to improve our ability to collect the loans. Years ago, a very wise decision, in my opinion, was made by this legislature to garnish the permanent fund dividend for defaulted borrowers. And as you will see in the annual reports that we will distribute to the members of the legislature next week, over $6 million was collected last year in the garnishment of permanent fund dividends. And this is a very effective tool to assist us in collecting on student loans. We have two provisions to improve the collections of loans, actually three. One deals with withholding warrants to businesses or individuals who are under contract with the state of Alaska. Two deals with withholding professional and occupational license. And let me be clear on what I mean by that. Simply mean that prior to issuing the renewal of the license or prior to issuing the warrant, it would be held in the case of a defaulted borrower until such time as that borrower got with the commission and brought his account current, and then the state could release the warrant or the state could issue the renewal of the license. We're not asking that the state offices that administer licenses or warrants actually have to garnish those funds at all. Third is a wage garnishment provisions. We currently now, at some point in time in the life of the loan, when it becomes defaulted, secure a judgment on the account. At the time we secure that judgment, we'd like the law change to allow us to also secure a court-ordered wage garnishment. The third theme in this legislation is a simplification of the administration of the loan program for both the borrower and the student. There is a provision in the Family Education Loan Program that requires currently that we collect families' IRS 1040s, and this provision would be deleted and we could administer that program without requiring that families submit their 1040s to us. The fourth theme is to prevent future abuses to the program under the example of bankruptcy. We have examples of students who have borrowed $30,000 to $40,000 under the Alaska Student Loan Program, filed bankruptcy, the court granted the bankruptcy, wiped out the debt, and the very next year they applied for another Alaska student loan. There is a provision in this bill that provides for a 5-year prohibition against eligibility after a bankruptcy proceeding. And that concludes my testimony, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Joel.
What I'd like to do at this time is, Joe, so that I can get your reaction to it, is to invite the Commissioner of Department of Administration, if she would like to join us at this time. I'm taking this a little out of order. Stay with us, Joe, if you would. You stay right there, and I'll have Nancy sit over here. Commissioner Ysera, I'd like to have you give your testimony at this time, since you have a recommended amendment.
Yes,
and that way we can get the professional response from the manager of the program.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Nancy Ysera, Commissioner, Department of Administration. This will come as no surprise to Mr. McCormick, but we oppose certain provisions in this piece of legislation. As a member of the board of the Student Loan Corporation, I voiced that concern before this bill even came forward. And we object to it on a public policy initiative, and that is that there are really three areas that we have problems with in this bill. I'll speak to the two that affect the Department of Administration first. And that is that this bill gives priority to garnishment of wages for student loans over and above all other garnishment attachments, with the exception of child support. We think that that's an unfair advantage. The public policy associated with this, that in fact student loans have a greater position for payment other than financial institution loans or federal levies or state levies of other types, which currently are in the order in which they're received, I think doesn't represent a sound prioritization of what we think people in Alaska need to be accountable for in terms of their debts. Clearly, we believe that tools need to be given to the Student Loan Corporation to be able to do a better job of making loans and getting a handle on their administrative functions, but I don't think that superseding private sector obligations is the way to go about it, and we have serious concerns about that prioritization. The other thing that we have a concern about is with regard to the holding up of any kind of vendor payments. The fact that someone comes in and has done a job for the state of Alaska, that they have satisfied the terms of a contract associated with this, and the fact that we would withhold a payment for that because of their student loan obligation, which has absolutely nothing to do with the performance of that contract, again, I think is an inappropriate punishment associated with this, and I think gives this debt a standing above and beyond all other debts that may be associated in the state. We all know that, for example, with the permanent fund dividend, you know, we went in not too long ago and allowed the public defender to attach permanent fund dividends for repayment of legal defense fees. That money comes back into the general fund. You know, all of these are tools that are available to us, and I think that that's an appropriate opportunity for people who are getting state funds to first have to pay back their obligations, whether it is public defenders or whether it's Student Loan Corporation, and that's an appropriate competition for that funding on the basis of who comes in first to get a hold of it, frankly. But we would offer for the committee's consideration amendment, which would be to delete on page 2, section 3, subsection 3, on page 5, section 6, subsection C, and sections 9 and 10, which affect the department.
Can we take them one at a time, then, Nancy? Sure. Start with the first line.
Right.
Give us the line and tell us what you...
It is line 22, and I'm operating off of the CS version E.
Mm-hmm. That's the one probably line, before us. Is that
page
correct?
Page 2,
that?
Right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Page 2, line 22, which is subsection C, shall provide notice of the default to the Department of Administration. I need to also mention that The Student Loan Corporation currently has the ability to garnish wages, as do all other creditors in the state. This doesn't give them any greater ability to garnish wages. What it does is it says that we get the first crack at somebody's wages right after child support. So this doesn't add or detract from their ability to garnish under a current judgment for default. So that would be the reference there on page 5.
What would you do on page 2?
I'm sorry, it would just be delete that subsection.
3?
Right, 3, Mr. Chairman.
So it'd be your recommendation, the First Amendment then.
Right. Would be to delete.
I think the committee would, unless we can understand this, would like to see anything like this in writing. And then, but anyway, let's just conceptually go over it.
We would be happy to do that,
and that's
right.
Page is 5. Representative
Port. So this, you think the effect of removing that is to remove their preference?
The Student Loan Corporation currently has the ability to garnish an employee's wages, as do all other creditors under the garnishment provisions. What the provisions in this bill, which are specifically referenced on page 5, section 6C, an assignment of wages made under court order has priority.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, then, I mean, I can understand removing that,
right,
if that's your goal.
So that's...
What do you think you've accomplished by removing lines 22
and
23?
It's a technical amendment, Representative Porter.
Just a technical amendment.
In terms of making the bill consistent.
Let me just look
with
for a second.
Provision,
okay.
The priority.
Right.
What's 3710?
It's a reference, Mr. Chairman, to section 10.
Let me just read this, and anyway, it simply says the Department of Administration shall disperse money only for vouchers certified by the department, establishment, or agency concerned, or an officer or employee of it and authorized in writing to certify the vouchers, make an examination of vouchers necessary to ascertain whether they are in proper form, certified and approved, computed on the basis of the facts certified, and be held accountable accordingly.
But Mr. Chairman, it's a reference to Section 10, which is the third piece of this amendment, which deals with the disbursement of vendor payments. Mm. And if you look on page 6, line 28, that's the site that you're looking for. It would add... Section 10 adds a new subsection to 3710.010.
Okay, that's the B section.
Right. So what this does is the First Amendment is a technical amendment which refers back to this. Without Section 10, you don't need the one on page 2.
That's the B.
Right.
These
and what
two.
What these three actions would do would be to remove priority for garnishment without affecting their ability to garnish. Secondly, it removes the requirement that we withhold vendor payments.
So tell me again the Second Amendment now. The lines, the page is 5.
Mr. Chairman, if I can, right, for simplicity, these are two different issues, and I feel differently about them.
Okay.
So if you could put together the one dealing with vendor payments and then separately the one dealing with priority,
okay,
on permanent fund.
Would you like them in that order, Representative Porter?
However you like them, but separated.
Right. Section, the vendor payments is page 6, section 10. The recommendation is to delete.
So for one amendment, in order to delete the vendor payment delay, we would want to delete page 2, line 22, 23,
and
page 6, section 10 entirely.
Right. That's correct.
Okay. We could have that as one amendment, then I would speak to that amendment, if that's what you want to do.
Yes, how does the committee feel about this? Are you following it, Representative Mulder?
I would, I'm not sure what Representative Porter is going to say, but in terms of...
Representative Mulder?
Yes. I'm not certain what Representative Porter was going to allude to, but I would as a policy statement as well. If we, on one hand, we're loaning money out as a state or a state-driven corporation. I mean, get down to the bottom line. We put the money into this corporation to begin with, and we're giving money out to students. And then on the other hand, we're saying, well, you know, you're going to come back here, you're in default, and we're going to give you, you're going to have a contract with the state and do work for us, and, well, we're going to turn a blind eye to the fact that we loaned you some money. You performed a job for us, so we're going to pay you for it and kind of take a blind eyes approach. I don't think that's very good public policy either. Well, I understand what you're saying, Commissioner, mm-hmm. about the fact that, you know, it has absolutely nothing to do with their work, but holding them accountable for their debts to the state, which in essence it is, I would move that we keep Section 10N as well as line Section 3.
Representative Porter?
That's exactly why I asked for the division. Mm-hmm. I can understand on a public policy basis a question at least, if not a decision not to place this as a priority within the permanent fund garnishments with mm-hmm. all the other garnishments that have public and private. But on this other issue, Representative Mulder said just what I was going to say.
Mm-hmm. I just mentioned, Mr. Chairman, that there would be a significant fiscal impact to our Division of Finance as well associated with this in terms of administering this provision. And while I understand and see your point of view, the funding source is not the same, and I would contend that we should have our checks and balances at the front end if we're
Isn't
going
there some
to complete.
Kind of administrative mechanism fund another division of government that impacts you?
RSAs or something.
Yeah, something like that. I mean, I would guess that the net of this function would be mm-hmm. a benefit to the state treasury, and that's why I think it would be good public policy. It
doesn't go into the state treasury. It goes into the Student Loan Corporation receipts.
Which is funded
out. Now, just a minute, because our machine over here doesn't know who's talking.
I'm sorry.
They might, but so if you try to go through the chair here, and then that way we can keep our machine squared away. Let's try Representative Settinger and
thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think, Commissioner, you answered the question largely that I had, and that is, what kind of problem does this cause for the department? And you hit on the cost there, and were there any other problems associated with it? Have to hire more people and all that stuff.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Sitton, yes. I mean, it is one of the things when you were talking about how many student loans are out? 100,000?
We have this is Joe McCormick, Mr. Chairman. We have approximately 130,000 loan accounts out. I think it would be a very small percentage of them that actually, under a contractual basis, conduct business for the state of Alaska.
And how many of those are in default, Mr. Chairman?
And that would be even smaller percentage.
What, quarter?
Correct. But, Mr. Chairman, in response to the question, at 120 files, we would have to scan. The way this is written is that the Division of Finance would have to make a determination as to whether or not someone was in default of their student loan prior to making a disbursement to a vendor. I don't think that is an effective and efficient or reasonable exercise to ask the Division of Finance to go through as a result of this. And this is not money, and I think it's important to remember what the funding source is for these loans. These are bonds. This is not GF. This is not coming out of the state treasury, nor is it being returned to the state treasury. It's going back into the revolving loan fund. And I don't know that, again, as a public policy matter, I absolutely would believe if this was something that was going into the Treasury and if it was for the general use of the state, that it would absolutely have priority. I mean, we have tremendous demands on this. But I'm suggesting to you that while I sit on this corporation board and I believe that the student loan program is a great loan program and I think it's a great opportunity for kids to be able to get financing, it is not a needs-based program, that the checks and balances are currently in the system, and that, in fact, we need to be sure that we are doing business effectively and not relying on artificial mechanisms to collect funds in competition with other, the odds are that if you're in default on your student loan, you may very well be default on a number of other loans. Is it fair that a financial institution that has done due diligence to try to collect on your car or on somebody's car loan or a federal levy should be not get their funds in lieu of this? I just don't think it makes sense.
Representative Sitton, then Mulder.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Can you give me an idea, so we can get an idea of the scale of this thing, Commissioner? In a typical quarter a year, like how many vendors would the state be dealing with? 50 or 300 or 3,000 or?
How many vendors?
There are 52,000 vendors.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, Representative Sitton, 52,000 vendors that we cut checks for.
Amazing. These numbers are amazing.
Sure.
I think, Mr. Chairman, you start to see our concern with this.
Let me get Representative Mulder and then Porter.
Following with one of your previous points, Commissioner, to hold consistent with your logic of what you're saying about, you know, being fair with the private sector and everything else, putting it back in their hands, if you were Joe businessman out there and you did business for Joe, and this is the same thing as saying, well, you did business for Joe, he didn't pay you, and this is outstanding, and you've been trying to pursue him, but Joe's been kind of delinquent for a while, and you can't seem to find him. But then all of a sudden it turns around, and you do business for Joe again. Well, you're going to be real reluctant to do business for Joe the second time, except for the fact that he's paid you for the first time. And that's really the policy question.
So, Mr. Chairman, may I? Thank you. Except that I would say to you, at what point and in what order do you make those decisions? Clearly, if, for example, if the state has had a bad experience with an individual, why would we be giving them a student loan to begin with, and yet there is no criteria there? There's no creditworthiness, well, except with regard to this specific program. If somebody has defaulted on a student loan in the past, there's a provision. But, for example, if there is an outstanding loan program with the Department of Commerce or an outstanding loan program or an outstanding indebtedness for something else in the state, they can still get a student loan. So while I understand your logic, it is it's a two-way street. You know, perhaps I would feel more comfortable with it if we said you can't get a student loan if you have any indebtedness to the state, for example, an outstanding traffic ticket, you know, an outstanding child support, an outstanding anything else. But those aren't criteria under the student loan program currently.
I understand your point, Commissioner. If I could pursue one.
Lenny Mulder.
Joe, the biggest problem I see with Commissioner's point here, I won't back off of the fact of the policy statement. If they're coming back for our money twice, once burned, twice shy. But is there any way, the biggest problem I see is the trying to meld 150,000 applicants or how many ever people that we have student loans as with 52,000 vendors or how many ever, and trying to, I mean, that's a huge nightmare.
Chairman Hudson, I think the issue really is a policy issue and not so much an administrative issue. The numbers are not large. 50,000 vendors, 120,000 loans. Of those 120,000 loans, approximately only 12,000 would ever be in default at any one time. And of that number, of that 12,000, probably no more than 1,200 at max would ever have a contract to do business with the state of Alaska. So from our end, we're not talking about a huge database in terms of transactions. I think we were talking about a tape exchange in which the computer would simply match up and on those that it could, and where there was a match, then some action would be taken. The effort here that we seek is not so much that we, in fact, are going to hold up someone's warrant. It is the psychology of it that, in fact, the state of Alaska is willing to do that if you are not sincere in keeping your payments up. And it's kind of like the strategy the IRS uses to collect taxes. You can avoid paying your taxes any time during the year, but once you're caught, the IRS does not take you to court except during the months of January through April, and they get as much press as they can out of it. And the psychology of that strategy is simply to send a message to the rest of us that we'd better pay our taxes by April 15th. there is a definite psychology to the collection of student loans. And we do need, I think, to send a strong message to people who borrow money under the program that the state of Alaska sincerely expects you to repay those funds. Thank you.
President Porter?
Mr. Chairman, that's precisely what I had envisioned, was that this was not going to be a clerk with an eye shade going over 150,000 lists over here. We've come a long way since then. We can run the delinquent list, which is about 12,000 people on a monthly basis or whatever, against the vendor list. That's a reasonably succinct operation, and I don't think it'd be that costly, considering what we could probably recover. And while I recognize that we're talking about two different funds, it's all state money.
Representative, Mr. Chairman, a technical question, actually in reference to Representative Porter here, if I may. Are these vendors on some list someplace, or they're in some computer as a list that you can access and so forth? I mean, I don't know.
I'd be very surprised if they weren't.
Commissioner?
It would be, as it's written, we would, before cutting a check to Don Q Contractor, we would have to scan the list to determine whether or not he was in default of a student loan prior to cut that check. It's an administrative cost associated with this. And the idea that some electronic function is going to do this for you and that there is no work associated with it is just simply not accurate. There is a tremendous amount of work associated with having to do selective disbursements.
All right.
Representative
Williams.
You were disagreeing with, or could you explain where the money is coming from or going, if it is all state funds?
Right, Mr. Chairman, the Representative Williams, the student loan is funded through bonding, where bonds are issued on an annual basis to fund the current level of loans. And perhaps if you want an in-depth review of this, I'm sure that Mr. McCormick can give you the short course in how this transpires. But what we've been trying to do is build up a revolving loan fund. And again, I am extremely sympathetic to the goal here, which is to be able to get sufficient return through the repayment of these loans to go into this revolving loan fund so that, in fact, there's new money available to pay for current student loans. And currently the default rate is too high to be able to sustain that level. There is a net loss every year in terms of what we're able to accomplish. And I'm extremely sympathetic to trying to get student loan fund on a business-like basis, and I absolutely agree with that goal, that it should be on a business-like basis. I just don't think this is that these two items that are contained in this bill are an appropriate remedy.
Let me see if I can find out the two sides here, the two positions here. Mr. McCormick, you believe that setting up a collection right behind child support or something of this nature there sends a strong message to other students.
Yes, sir.
That you either pay up or you'll have your permanent fund dividend garnish sheet or something of this nature. And that's the relationship that you see with the provisions in the bill. Is that correct?
That's correct, sir.
And Commissioner, your concern is that the provisions within the bill present the finance division with an extraordinary effort on or additional expense of, are you talking about the policy or are you talking about the mechanical the process itself, Commissioner?
There are, Mr. Chairman, we've just flip-flopped. One, the prior conversation had to do with vendor payments. Mm-hmm. Vendor payments we see as adding a tremendous amount of inefficiency and administrative burden to the Division of Finance that year after year after year is coming under tremendous constraints to be able to do a job, their primary job, more cost-effectively. This is one additional burden on them. We don't have the resources to do it. If somebody wanted to suggest that, in fact, the Division of Finance was going to receive an RSA through some sort of a funding mechanism in order to do this collection, we might reconsider. I mean, if that's a possibility, I don't know how that's going to do. the public policy in terms of the positioning of garnishment.
Who gets whatever's garnished first.
Is the order that I think is a very significant public policy issue that I think is a real concern. Mm-hmm.
Representative Green, and then Joe, would you like to respond? Can we get Joe's response to that first, Mr. Vice Chair? Mr. McCormick, sir?
Chairman Hudson, Commissioner Ussera, I would certainly entertain a reasonable chargeback by the department for the cost of conducting this match. And if that cost were prohibitive, then we simply would not do that. A similar arrangement is under consideration with the department that deals with the issuance of occupation and professional license, that in fact, if this bill were to pass, they would charge us a fee for the administrative cost incurred in carrying out that provision of the bill. I see no reason that the Department of Administration shouldn't be allowed to do the same thing.
Representative Green?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. 120,000 loans and 10% of those are delinquent. Is that regardless of where the student went, or do you have a higher delinquency rate for those students that may have gone outside the school and stayed outside? And if that's the case, can you garnish outside the state?
Chairman Hudson, Representative Green, you can garnish outside the state, but you have to weigh the cost of doing that when you do. And it could be if a student only owes $1,200 and they live in South Carolina, it may be cost prohibitive for you to incur the legal expense that you would have to go to actually garnish the wage in South Carolina from Juneau, Alaska. We can break it down by whether it was an in-state borrower or an out-of-state borrower. I don't have that data available with me today.
Do you have a feel for whether it's about the same, whether it's in-state or out-of-state, or is there a higher percentage of default outside?
I would doubt that there is a direct relationship between whether he defaulted and he went outside the state versus inside the state. Over the last 4 years, you've seen a shift in the participation to 60-plus percent of the students who borrow now are staying in-state and going to an Alaska institution. So the numbers who actually go out-of-state is somewhat declining from what it used to be in years past.
If I might follow up.
Mr. Vice Chair.
Then you're talking that it was above 40% that went outside.
Yes.
And so of the delinquent faults that are out, a significant number of those would be outside the state.
Yes.
Now, is that also a delinquent amount is also quite high? Or you gave an example of a rather small amount, but are there some big loans to outside schools since tuitions are higher? And
yes, there's definitely that. I think it would be, and I'm just guessing, but to me it would be very rare that we would have a out-of-state delinquent borrower who was about to be issued a contract for doing business with the state of Alaska. So I think most of the people that would be affected by this provision probably would be residents of the state of Alaska. And like I say, that is just a guess on my part.
So we're not going to have any effect on those who don't want to license.
Okay, what we're going to do, Commissioner, we would like the amendments in writing, five-page line and specifics with some backup, if you would, please. What I'm going to do at this time is I'm going to go on through the balance of those that wish to testify on this, and then we're going to hold it over and we'll keep it alive until the next time we meet, and we'll consider the amendments at that point in time. I think that's the best way. So McCormick will do that. let's see. I have...
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Joe. Well, Helen Finney is not here. I don't see her. Okay. I hear you, Helen. We'll get to you in just a minute. I know her. I can speak like that.
It'd be nice to Helen.
I will, Mr. Williams.
We insist upon it.
All right. What we're going to do now is we're going to go out on teleconference here, and I'm going to go to Sitka first, to Ms. Paige Adams. You're on the top of my list here. Paige, would you like to step up and give us your testimony, please, on House Bill number 506?
Thank you for your time, Mr. Chairman. I'm a student at UAS, and I'm also a member of the Coalition of Student Leaders. And I would just like to say that the students support the commission's recommendations for these bills for House Bill 506. And I have nothing further to add at the moment.
Thank you very much, Ms. Adams. And next we'll go to Tracy Cohen, Kenai Soldatna.
Yes, thank you very much for allowing me to speak here today. My name is Tracy Cohen, and I am a student representing students at Kenai Peninsula College and also the Student Network Statewide Coalition. I would like to say that students do support the commission and that we perceive that the commission works with students all across the state. All a student would have to do is contact the commission, and that student would no longer be in default on their loan. I support the wage garnishment and the prioritization on the permanent fund, and also I support that people who are in default should not be allowed to take state money in the form of state contracts or reimbursement for work. How can you, on the one hand, take money from the state, yet be expected that the state's going to hand you back money when you're in default of your loan? That's not very realistic. When you default on other loans, you are expected to pay, and we do need to send a strong message to students that they have to pay back the money that they borrowed. I kind of took offense of Ms. Usera's calling us kids. I'm a 35-year-old woman with three children myself, trying to make a better living for myself and my children, and many students that are affected by this program, the state loan program, are not children, we're not kids, we're people who can be expected to pay back loans that we borrow from. I'd also like to see this student loan program protected. I think that we need to send a message people that if you're going to borrow money, then it needs to be paid back, and if you're not going to pay it back, then you can expect that your wages will be garnished. That's what I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Cohen. Next, I will go to Helen Finney in Ward Cove.
Oh, thank you.
Helen, Bill Williams tells me I got to treat you really nice now, Helen. So.
Well, that's how I used to be. You're treated so thanks. I appreciate it. This is Helen Finney, and I'm commissioner with the Statesville Secondary Education Committee, and I would like to speak in support of House Bill 506. I feel very briefly that we can't overstate the importance of the Alaska Student Loan Program to the state, to the quality of life that we have because of this program. Definitely enhanced it. And also, I can't overstate the importance of using all the available means to ensure that these loans are paid back. Our society in general doesn't always take personal debt seriously, and we at ACDE need the dollars to keep the program going. We can't afford to let them dribble away on bad debts. And we also, it would be just an additional learning experience that maybe some of the borrowers didn't get the first time around if they can get anywhere else. But in fairness to the rest, the ones who do pay back, the thousands and thousands that have scripts and saved to pay back their loans, we need to go as hard without deviating, without changing our course, we need to go after the ones who would. And my comments for the day, and thank you.
Thank you, Helen. Any questions? All right, next I'd like to go to Brian Brebaker, online, I believe, at the UAF campus.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman, for this opportunity. My name is Brian Brebaker, and I'm the coordinator for the Statewide Student Network, the Coalition of Student Leaders. I'd just like to reiterate that the coalition is in support of the CPE recommendations, and also we would like to see that the cap on the interest rate have a variable rate, but cap it at a maximum percentage possible. And that's in Fairbanks at the university campus. We have Nick Abramchuk, ASUAF Legislative Affairs Coordinator.
All right. First of all, I have a question. I don't believe there is a cap in this bill. Is that?
Thank you. I would also like to offer my support along with my fellow students. Say that I am also a member of the Getting a Student Loan Program, and I am in support of the recommendations we have for it. I recognize that what the chairman just commented on about a cap is not in this at this time. We would request that somebody would propose an amendment that would put a cap in here. We had tried in the earlier committees and did not receive that. We would like to see a 15% cap put in there. Now, although that's not a very popular idea, we'd like to add that this is for continuing education, and that it's not a very popular idea, but we need to look at it, that this is for our students, and that a cap should be reasonably put in there for the situation of an education. I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Nick. We'll take a look at that when we bring this back the next time around. Next, oh, this is another bill. Okay, I believe that's all of those on teleconference. Anyone else out there wish to testify on 506 at this time before we move back here?
This is Bing Sassamore Bethel.
Please go ahead, please.
Yes,
Your name again, please.
I'm sorry?
Could we have your name again, please? I'm sorry, I didn't get it.
That's okay. Bing, B and boy, I-N-G, Sassamore, like Santa Claus, small M-O-U-R, Sassamore.
Thank you, Bing. I do have it in front of me now. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Regarding this House Bill 506, I'd like to mention that I am in favor of a majority of what you have in here. Now, I have to agree with the gentleman right ahead of me who stressed the need, at least on behalf of future students, benefits having an interest rate cap. And as a clarification, mainly you can take this up in your discussion, like beginning on your page 3, line 9, 10, says scholarship loan. The words scholarship loan are contradictory. It's also mentioned further down that page, line 25, 26. They're very contradictory, and perhaps discussion can be made to change it. If you read through it, all the language before that says loan, loan, loan. Doesn't say anything about scholarship loan, then it pops up under the section 5. And you can take that up and do with it as you please, I guess.
Thank you,
Bing. You get an A for the day.
Right. Everybody around here got a PhD.
Bing just zinged us.
I think Bing zinged, yeah. Thanks, Bing, we will...
I hope I don't have to zing you again.
You can zing us anytime you want.
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, thank you, well. You'll hear from me again, and thanks for your time.
Thank you. Thank you. Joe, we'll expect you to see if we can make that square.
Mr. Chairman, I think when this program first started and there were forgivenesses and all those kinds of things, you could call it a scholarship loan, but now it's Bing is correct.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's no longer a scholarship. Next, we'll go to Dillingham for Mr. Steve Levinson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Steve Levinson. I'm testifying on behalf of the Dillingham Chamber of Commerce and the Alaska State Chamber of Commerce, both of which have adopted resolutions in support of reform of the program, and the State Chamber especially, which supports this bill. I take exception to Commissioner Ucera's objections in that, as Commissioner McCormick, or as Director McCormick said, the cost of administering any screening program can be passed back to the student loan program and added to the cost of the loan. Chamber of Commerce, the State Chamber of Commerce, supports the concept of a floating rate formula. And a formula tied, as this one does, to the lowest possible cost of funds. We would oppose a cap for the simple reason that if the cost of funds exceeds a nominal cap, then the program would no longer be available to students.
Thank you very much, Mr. Levinson. I do have Bobbitt Bush from ANIAC. If you're there and wish to testify, if you're not there, don't wish to testify. She's not online. She's not here. All right. I had her on my list here, so, and I thought perhaps she was on the line.
She was supposed to call in. Apparently, she did not.
She didn't make it. Okay. All right. Good enough. Well, that then completes the people who have signed up to testify.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
This is Tracy Cohen in Kenai, and I had one further thing I'd like to ask.
Please go ahead, Tracy.
I really perceive that our permanent fund is a privilege, and it's a privilege that those students who are in default on loans don't deserve. Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right. Representative Mulder.
Mr. Chairman, if I might have one last question. Joe, several of the students brought up the question of capping the interest rate. Why was that not included, or was that ever considered?
Chairman Hudson.
Yes, Ms. McCormick.
That was considered, but some of us are old enough to remember when the prime rate of interest hit 22%. I hope, you know, we never see that again in our lifetimes. And we feel that it defeats the purpose of a variable rate, and it defeats the purpose of always ensuring that the loan program is financially sound in that its interest rate is tied to the cost of money and to the cost of administering the program. And if you put the cap on it, there is the possibility that we would be back to you at some later time asking the cap be revised upward or downward. So that was the reason we chose not to put a cap in there.
All right. Thanks for coming.
Thanks, Joe.
And I believe we'll go ahead and move on to the next bill at this time then, and we will bring this will stay alive. And Commissioner Sheriff, you would give us your amendment.
Mr. Chairman, when will this be back up? Do we know?
Probably Thursday is our next meeting. We will have it alive on Thursday.
We will have the information that you need by then, Mr. Chairman.
All right, fine. Thank you. And Ms. McCormick, if you could take care of Bing Zinger.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman.
We'll help us square that one away.
Mr. Chairman, before we leave this, is there a mechanism that would be put in the bill to allow the interfund changing for the administrations being
RSAs,
or is that just something that can be accomplished administratively?
Mr. Chairman, we specifically put in the bill that the effective date would not be until July 1 of 1995, which means it would be FY96's budget year. It would give us 12 months to get with the Department of Administration and with the department that issues licenses to work out the mechanics and to get the necessary provisions in their budgets in order to carry this out.
Nothing that would have to be done in here, though, that would preclude that from happening.
No.
And I think I understand, Representative, that that we could fashion an RSA, from what they call program receipts, I believe, to whatever fiscal note that the commissioner might come up with in administration.
Sure.
Next, we're going to take up House Bill number 497, and we do have Representative Joe Green here. And Joe, if you'd like to introduce us to this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a rather minor piece of legislation, but it does make quite a difference to at least one of our major cooperative electric generator and distribution companies. It's in essence just to modify a restriction that now exists in statute, allowing a company, particularly this one cooperative, to make the name changes as shown in the bill. That, in other words, what is now considered a president could be called a chairman or chairwoman, and from a vice president to a vice chairwoman or chairman, and Mr. Chairman, the reason this is before you is that this particular cooperative, the largest in the state and one of the largest in the country, has gotten away from REA financing. And when they go back to do business with financing institutions, mm-hmm. primarily in New York, the current attitude for people that deal with financing of this magnitude are not familiar with dealing with, for example, under current the way they're currently called, a person who might be called the general manager. That term could then be, under this bill, called the president, and the president, that is now the operative officer of the board of directors, would then become a chairperson, chairwoman, or chairman. In dealing with these financial institutions, general managers are kind of looked at askance, and it's the belief of this company cooperative, and I as the sponsor, that by making this minor modification doesn't require it, it just allows them. Mm-hmm. And I would certainly suggest that this be enacted, and I'd be glad to answer any questions. Or we have in the audience Larry Markley, who would be willing to address, and we have by teleconference, I believe, a couple of gentlemen that also would be willing to talk about this bill, if there are any questions.
Any questions from the committee of the sponsor, Vice Chair? All right, thank you. All right, on teleconference on 497, House Bill 497, Dave Hutchins. Dave, you'll have to get right up close to your mic. Where you're breaking up on me, sir.
Well, lean over the table a bit here.
Good.
Again, I'm just here in support of House Bill 497. From our perspective, Representative Joe Green has done a fine job of explaining the background to it. And I'm basically here to answer any questions if he has any. But if this kind of detail probably should never have been in the statute in the first place. But since it is, we have to come to the legislature to ask you to amend it when the situation has changed. Not all of our utilities are REA borrowers nowadays. So it's important that we be able to use standard business titles when the situation is. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Dave. Next, Dan Bloomer, please.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dan Bloomer. I'm the Executive Assistant to the General Manager of the Hugh Electric Association. And I guess I just want to kind of echo the statements made by Mr. Hutchins and also by Representative Green. Hugh appreciates Representative Green bringing the legislation forward as pretty much a housekeeping matter. Mr. Hutchins described to statute that will allow us to work here in a better fashion than peers. Right from that, I'd like to, if you have any questions, for your perspective on the.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions? Is there any questions of Mr. Markley or anybody else? Representative Mulder?
Only a question of Representative Green. In the past recommendations or past reports, there was one member who signed "do amend." How do you, what amendments were ever recommended for this bill?
Representative Porter?
Perhaps. And I'm not trying to be facetious when I say, are these the terms, since I agree with the fact that this detail should never have been in statute, but are these the terms that are currently politically correct? Chairwoman, is that the thing to say now, as opposed to Madam Chairman or something like that?
I think that the salutation might be Madam Chairman or Chairwoman, but
I don't pretend to know.
Vice Chairman or Chairwoman or Chairman,
Mr. Chairman,
probably correct, Representative Settings.
Just, Mr. Chairman, in reference to the comment of my good friend, Representative Porter, we basically don't care if it's politically correct or not.
The Everybody plug him in.
I like your attitude.
Representative Mulder, let's have a movement. I don't mean a revolution.
Mr. Chairman, with that, I would move HB 490, let's see, once. CS for SB for HB 497 from the LNC committee with accompanying fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
Are there any objections? Hearing none, so done.
That's in my golden anniversary. I did it.
PC, right?
I don't care about this.
All right, now we'll go to Senate Bill 212. And would you like to join us at the table, please?
Mr. Chairman.
This sponsor, Senate Labor and Commerce Committee, by request of the Senate Economic Task Force. Please.
Thanks again, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Josh Fink, aide to Senator Kelly, the chair of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. He would like to have been here, but unfortunately, well, he's upstairs chairing the Senate Labor and Commerce meeting. So I'm here in his stead.
Pardon me, Mr. Chairman. Could I make a technical inquiry?
Yes, you may.
Are the tire treads on my bill folder a commentary from the committee?
I have the same ones.
Where the rubber meets the road.
That's right.
Thank you.
Not me,
you
mean.
Representative, are you satisfied that you're not being picked on?
No, I see we've uniformly been run over here, so.
Not regularly.
Please, Josh, go ahead.
Bear with us, Josh. It's late in the day.
Normal function around here.
You got to see us on Thursday.
Anyway, this bill was in the 17th legislature. It's been massaged a bit. It was Representative Choquette had introduced it, and I believe it had 40 co-sponsors in the House, but I may be off on a co-sponsor or two. But anyway, the basic thought behind this bill, state government is one of the largest purchasers of goods and services in our economy. And SB 212 aims to help strengthen Alaska's economy by increasing the share of state contracts going to Alaskan businesses. Specifically, this legislation would establish an innovative construction procurement methods pilot program within the Department of Transportation for a period of 2 years to implement an Alaska bonus program to replace the current preferences. Allowing DOTPUF to test on a trial basis a bonus system which provides bonuses at project completion and encourages the same policy goals would be more economically beneficial for vendors, reduce administrative costs and bid protests, and could likely be used in joint federal-state projects where state preferences are currently not allowed. In addition, it would provide an incentive to use Alaskan products where the current product preference is underutilized and could possibly be used to provide bonuses for Alaskan hire. Lastly, this bill incorporates a number of provisions from the Make Alaska legislation from the 17th legislature, House Bill 245, which would also increase the amount of state work going to Alaskans. This bill would, one, encourage procurement officers to restrict notice of contract solicitation to Alaskan suppliers and providers of services desiring to compete for state contract work. This practice is already standard in DOT. Two, it would require the commissioner to include in his report to the legislature on state procurements the number of bidders located in-state and out-of-state that bid or made proposals on procurements. And that would be for tracking purposes to see the effect of the legislation, Mr. Chairman. And thirdly, it would replace the statutory requirement that state publications be produced at a state-operated facility with a requirement that state publications be produced at a private sector facility located in the state when practicable. In addition, standards for the production of publications would be established by the Department of Administration, and a cost box would be required for all publications exceeding $1,500 in cost. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'm available for any questions.
Thank you. Any questions for the representative sponsor? All right. Next, we'll go to Chris Gates, Commerce.
Chairman, members of the committee, the Department of, my name is Christopher Gates. I'm your director of the Division of Economic Development in the Department of Commerce, and we've been working hard on one particular section of this bill for over a year now, and that's Section 8, the Innovative Construction Procurement Methods Pilot Program, quite a mouthful. But it does some very important things, we think, to stimulate commerce in the state, and I'm just going to just tell you in summary, to try and make this fairly quickly, why we are supporting this bill, and then stand aside for any questions that you might have. Basically, we think that this bill will allow us to offer incentives for state procurement incentives for federal contracts, about $200 million of federal state highway aid contracts that we're not able to offer incentives on right now. Because of the after-the-fact bonus nature of the program, instead of the bid-based current preference system, we think we'll be able to offer those incentives throughout the life of federal trust fund construction projects in the state of Alaska, very significant amounts of money to encourage state subcontractors, to encourage the purchase of state supplies throughout the course of construction. We also think that this bill cures a whole bunch of administrative problems that we have with the present bid-based program, not the least of which is trying to tally results and trying to do everything up front on a project to determine who the low bidder really is on a project. In this room is Lauren Rasmussen with DOT, can talk about some of the real penalties of and difficulties with the present system, and I'm sure he can enlighten you on how difficult it is to determine who the low bidder really is on a bid-based system. This project, this Section 8, allows DOT to have one accounting at the end of the project, how much Alaska products were used, how many Alaskan subcontractors, how much Alaskan hire was done, and determine a bonus at that time to the contractor, basically providing an incentive throughout the life of the contract, throughout the life of the project, for the use of Alaskan stuff, Alaskan subcontractors, products, etc. That only exists now at the beginning, at the time of bid, under the present program, and we think that that this is a much better way of doing it than we have in the past. I'd also like to say we think it also encourages the substitution of Alaskan products during the course of projects, during the course especially of construction projects, where that incentive for substitution does not currently exist. We have a lot of comments, a lot of details that we've worked on, but my comments are specifically focusing on Section 8, this innovative bonus method, and I stand ready to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Yes, I would say I agree with your comments, that's for certain. Susan Petty, are you here for questions? I want to get Risa Jarrell up here because I want to hear her say, we support this bill.
After the other day, what can I say? Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Risa Jarrell. I'm the State Director for National Federation of Independent Business. On behalf of my 4,400 members, I'm very happy to be here today, as opposed to the other day. As you know, I conduct a poll of my members every year on various issues, and the issue of government competition with private business was on our poll a few years ago, and 83% of my members voted to get government out of competing with small businesses. So that's basically where I'm coming from. I've given you a list of things the government does in competition with small business, and we see that as many of those that we can eliminate, if I knock one off a year, I feel like I've accomplished something, so I keep working on the list. So if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Questions? Thank you very much, Risa. Josh Warner, Alaska Corporation Printing. Welcome, Josh.
Hi. For the record, my name is Josh Warner, and I'm Alaska Corporation Printing, and I'm a fairly very new business in as far as printing in town, but I've been printing for about 15 years, and I've made some photocopies of or prepared some packets for each of you to kind of read, and I'll just babble along as you read, maybe. But I think that 212 is one of the greatest initiatives that I've seen come across that's come to my attention, because I not only do I feel that in-house print shops or centralized duplication is a thing long past. It was a great idea when it started, and at one point in our history it was cost efficient, but now with technological advances interfacing computers with photocopiers and different things, not to give time frame a plug or anything, but there's a very serious adversary for this industry period. And there's also the another point, just to kind of make it in brief, there's not the initiative for in the central duplication or in-house print shops or incentives for people to for advancement or for attaboys or pat on the backs and things like that. And there's really not that much incentive for them, for in that situation, to stay until 4 or 5 in the morning to run a job for someone. But when you're in the private sector, you have to do that, or you're not going to be, or your competition's going to get your business the next time. Mm-hmm. And it's those kind of incentives that I personally have never felt in my life until now as a small business owner. And it's kind of changed the whole picture. And I just really support this bill. And I think it's even good from the DOT standpoint. I think that that's an excellent idea as far as, you know, to have it, get it in a, almost like a subsidy kind of deal. I think that's a lot better. It'll kind of help out that way. But I don't want to make it long drawn out because you guys want to go home. So.
When you got the votes, you don't talk. The only time you talk is when you don't have the votes. Then right. You just keep talking. Thanks. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Hudson.
Appreciate it. Lauren, did you want to add anything to this? Are there any questions of Lauren Rasmussen? I think that this this concept of how it might affect the public works things could, just for the record, might not hurt to just have a little bit of how that might work.
For the record, my name is Lauren Rasmussen. I'm a chief of our design and construction standards for the Department of Transportation. First and foremost, I would like to tell you that we are not doing away with 3630, the competitive seal bidding process. We would still use that as a fundamental way of awarding contracts. But we would like to have an opportunity to see what we can do to improve use of Alaska products preferences, subcontracting, and to the big one would be to see if we can even look at Alaska Hire. Now, those are all questions, particularly Alaska Hire one, of which is a very complex problem, and we don't even have the authority to go to the Attorney General and see if we can craft something. Under this bill, as an experimental process, we could try to craft something that would be acceptable. And basically what you do is you award a contract through the competitive seal bidding process, and then you put on in your specifications, and we can set out the parameters and regulation ahead of time so that people know, and then clearly defining in the specifications how we're going to award these bonuses. And the bonuses could be for minority business enterprise, local hire, local products. And then we would cap the total amount of bonuses for, say, 5% on a project. And then that 5% would make up of various elements in it. It might be 2% for subcontracting, 2% for minorities, 2% for products. And you could actually have, if you got them all, you would get more than 5%, but we would cap it at 5%. So then at the end of the project, you would come in or have the contractors come to the department and tell us exactly how they met it by showing us their invoices or their records of payment to the men, the payroll, I shouldn't say men, to the workers so that we would have payrolls. And that way you could actually define it at the end. It could be, and the bookkeeping would be so much less because, and we have some, obviously, we have some experience in this area. We had a very difficult time for many years meeting our minority business enterprise programs. And basically, it was because it was a thumbs-on. You had to do it. You had to have a lot of paperwork. And we tried to look at ways of solving that problem, and we came up with a bonus liquidated damages clause in which you had a level that you had to meet. If you met over that level, then you got a bonus. If you were under it, we took money back. And you came in at the end of the contractors come in at the end of the project and show you what they paid subcontractors that were minorities. And the bookkeeping and the process just diminished tremendously. We could keep track of it much easier. Contractors seemed to get along with it better. And we actually got some increases in minorities because halfway through the contract, they could find another minority and replace it. So we got, the one caveat that I must tell you, though, is any program like this does cost money. So we would, and that's another thing that we think would be good about a program like this is we could come back and tell you what these programs cost, because it would be state funds. Now, in most cases, that wouldn't amount to much, you know, in a huge amount of money, and we can use it in our CIP project. We would just build a little less pavement, and part of that would go for the bonuses and those. That's the way we would work it. So we wouldn't actually ask for any additional money. You would just get a little less building, and we would use part of that funding for our bonus programs, and we could adjust it. Why we wanted experimental, because we're not quite sure where all those levels should be and the detail that you need to go to. And in order to have an effective program, you have to have some flexibility in order to make it work. And if we guess wrong and put it in statutes, it's very difficult to get it changed. And so we'd like to have some flexibility and be able to report back to you. Any other questions?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Your department currently, I think, exceeds the federal standards for minority business enterprise and so forth. And am I right in understanding this, that this innovative pilot program won't get in the way of you doing your minority business enterprise function
No, through the chair, no, it would not. It would be just an integral part of it. It would be one element. And that is one area that we would almost mirror exactly what we're doing now. Mm-hmm. We wouldn't change that at all.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mm-hmm. And we have exceeded the goals, and I think we normally have about 10%, and we're up to 12, 14%.
Yeah. We're very, very grateful for that, too. Mm-hmm.
All right. Thank you very much, Lauren. Now there's a question from Representative Mulder.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To the extent that this is a pilot program, is that to explain Sections 2 and 3 and the effective dates in relation to we're amending it to be in place for 4 years and then we return back to current statute after 4 years?
I can answer that question, but that Section 3, and I think I don't know what other section it is, really doesn't apply to the innovative program at all. It applies to when we advertise and where we advertise contracts. Presently, the law says that we advertise a certain way, 21 days, and the new one would go into effect and says you can't advertise outside of the state.
Oh.
And then 4 years from now, that one would drop out, sunset, and the present law would go back into effect. That's that technicality.
All right. Any questions? All right. We did have a...
thank you.
Mr. Vice Chair, did you have an amendment, sir, that you'd like to try to get some comment on?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do, as a matter of fact, have an amendment that I'm passing out that I would like to propose. And this falls under the intent language in the first part of the bill. It would fit in on page 2 at line 30. In essence, what it's doing is continuing the attitude that we want to promote Alaska, and this particular amendment would address investment and brokerage services that are currently in some degree fall outside the state. And what happens if a brokerage company that operates in-state and out-of-state, if a large order is made, the commissions that would normally be proportional would fall all outside the state. And so what this amendment would do, originally I was going to try and make it a 51% type thing so that we would ensure that we would get a large share of this to stay in Alaska. And by doing that, this would force the brokerage to probably expand their office within the state, and there would be more jobs and so on. I've since pulled off of that, and that's not unusual. For example, the state of Hawaii requires 100% that it be within the state. I think that's too severe, and certainly as far as, I'm sorry, the Alaska Permanent Fund, people with the fund indicated that they were opposed to having it so restrictive as even to give a percentage because they don't feel that the in-house brokerages are capable of handling the large volume or large amount. I personally disagree with that, but I'm not going to force that issue. And they have no problem with suggesting that we encourage they as well as others to use in-house whenever possible, but it's not a restriction that they have to. And I have talked with the representative of the maker of the bill, and he has no objection to this. And so I would offer this as an amendment to continue with the intent that we have in the first part of this bill.
Josh, did you want to speak to it at all?
Mr. Chairman, only that... Senator Kelly would have no objection. There was language really similar to this in the bill initially. It was taken out for, there was some concern that some other legislation could get tagged on it if that remained in the title, so for those reasons we tightened up. But it was originally in the bill, and Senator Kelly would be supportive of the amendment.
Right. I might add, too, this language does not cause does not go against a single issue in the title. So the earlier amendment that was there would have actually caused a bit of a problem and title change. So.
Staff, did we discuss this with permanent fund division people?
Yes.
Not the division people, but the permanent fund
people.
Yes. They're not unhappy.
No, this was all right.
Yeah. All right. I think we got a good consensus amendment here then, but so you're offering this amendment?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chairman.
The amendment has been offered. Are there any objections? Hearing none. Adopted. We have now before committee substitute symbol number 212, finance amended. It's no longer finance, it's now labor and commerce amended. And the chair is seeking out a representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would recommend that House committee substitute for committee substitute for Senate bill number 212, labor and commerce, as amended, be moved out of committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note, I believe.
Yes.
Yes, there are.
Could you restate that, please?
For the interest of Joseph.
No, we got
who,
oh,
who wears funny
five
underwear.
Seconds or less. In 5 seconds or less.
Let the record strike that last time. That's all right on the floor, but not here.
Not all right on the floor either.
Let me just point out to the committee before we just finalize the thing here that I notice that there is a Dugan Petty General Services has indicated a $256,100 fiscal note, and it's not allocated to any division or department, but simply it's an estimate what they believe at any rate may be the potential cost impacts of agencies that are trying to, say, do business within the state of Alaska versus going out strictly for an open competitive bid wherever it might occur. I don't know whether we consider this a zero fiscal note with a statement, or that's the way I'm going to take it, as a zero fiscal note with a potential economic across-the-board agency statement, and leave it at that. And I hope the committee agrees with me on that.
I think the footnote verifies what
right.
you just said.
All right. So any objections then to, or have we already moved this?
We have
moved it.
We have.
All right. Well, I'll bang it. There you are. See? We're rolling right along here now. Sponsors, substitute for House Bill number 487.
Actually, it's 97.
Am I on the wrong one?
We
no.
did a 487.
Oh, it's 487.
Well,
there's 487.
Which one are we doing? There's two.
487. Oh. 497 was the first one that we took
right.
up, and we held it over for Nancy Bear.
No.
No, we did 489. We held that. We passed that. 506 is what we held over.
Yeah, we held over the first one so we can take a look at it.
Right.
Cooperative was 497.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
So now we're
487 is the one we're working on now.
Representative Cott's bill that was
right.
held over.
Yes.
Yes. Now, just so the committee will recollect, we did hear this last time, and we heard considerable concern from about constitutionality and overreaching and those types of things. And I had some concerns along those lines myself. So we essentially put the issue into a subcommittee of Representative Sitzman, myself, and I think we instructed the prime sponsor to come back another day with something we'd like. So would you like to go ahead and...
Is that interesting introduction there, Mr. Chairman? Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I also would like to express, for the record, Jack Phelps, aide to Representative Cott, and I'd like to express Representative Cott's gratitude to the subcommittee chairman and member for allowing us to get this back up on the table this quickly. What I'd like to do is to just very quickly go through the differences between the proposed committee substitute that you have before you and what we had the last time we met together. Briefly, we've added a section of intent, but let me say that the remainder of the bill represents a dramatic change from what we had before, and essentially the changes amount to removing the labeling requirements that were previously on recorded material, and dropping back from a restriction upon any display. Which the previous bill had and raised concerns both in committee and by the Department of Law about its effect in homes, hospitals, schools, libraries, and so forth. The bill now only restricts sale and display for sale, so it's zeroed in on commercial activities. Secondly, it only would restrict the sale of certain material to minors and would restrict the display for sale when minors were likely to be present or allowed to be present. The other major change to the bill is that the expansive definition of what was harmful to minors has been greatly reduced and very much narrowed. The industry expressed a concern of vagueness and overreaching, as the chairman mentioned earlier, and the bill currently has dropped essentially back to an obscenity standard, and it draws language from the Miller decision of the U.S. Supreme Court that defined obscenity. It is slightly more expansive than that because it would be obscene as relates to minors. okay, which is arguably a slightly different standard than what is obscene to adults. It would encompass all material that is obscene for adults and slightly more based on contemporary community standards as relates to minors. Okay. The bill also now provides an affirmative defense for a person who makes a bona fide attempt to determine the age of the purchaser, and if it defines what a bona fide attempt means. So that what we're trying to do, members of the committee, is to make it very clear what is expected here. We've tried to eliminate any and all vagueness. And that accounts also for the very particular definitions that occur on page 3 of the proposed committee substitute. Do you not have a copy of it?
No. I thought you were talking about going, oh, that's pretty encompassing.
Oh, yeah.
To be included on just in those lines.
Just for a minute here. I was trying to follow the amendments
There's a cover memo like this.
You have this?
No.
That's what we're working on.
There was one delivered to your office this morning.
That's okay, but they're making it.
I do have an extra copy here.
He's making some more copies of the bill.
Okay, of the bill without the memo. And there's one with the memo, so.
Okay.
I don't need the memo. I've got a copy of the bill in front of me.
let's do something here, then, just so that we're singing from the same sheet of paper here. I think we should go ahead and adopt the J version 322-94, committee substitute, response substitute, House Bill number 487, Labor and Commerce, and then we can determine if there are any amendments from that. And that way we'll be speaking, what you're speaking about is what we'll have in front of us and working from.
I apologize, Mr. Chairman. I was under the assumption that you had the committee substitute in front of you.
Well, are there any objections to adopting
319.
That?
319.
What did you have?
It's
322-94. So on here comes the copy we're looking for.
3 what?
J.
322.
Oh, hell, I don't know that. Or 319.
There you go.
Mr. Chairman,
it's coming around now.
It's 319.
I have one.
Yeah.
Mine's 319. You have a 322 version?
You have it now there, too.
No, I've got
319.
How come mine's different than what I do wrong?
Mr. Chairman, if it would be helpful, I could tell you there's only one very small difference between 319 and 322, and I can point it out to you very quickly.
All right, why don't you do that?
Which one?
Okay,
I've got
319. Yeah. Okay. The one that's dated 319, or it doesn't matter which one you have in front of you, if you'll turn to page 3, line 11. If you have the one that's dated 319, CDs, compact discs are not in there.
Oh.
Mm. And that was an inadvertent drafting error. 322 simply put CDs back in. That is the only difference between the 319 draft and the 322 draft.
Line 11 after record.
That's correct.
And compact disc.
Yes.
Comma, and then the balance of it, right?
Right, that's correct.
All right. That, incidentally, is the 322-94 version. So why don't you just redate yours up at the top, 322-94, with adding that CD in, and then we'll all be singing from the same road. same line here. All right. So then we have then officially adopted. There was no objections to adopting of this draft for discussion purposes. All right. So done. It's before us. Staff has it, huh?
Yes.
Good. All right. All right. Now go ahead, please.
Mr. Chairman, did you want me to repeat the comments that I made about the changes that are in here? I'd be happy to do that.
I think you better, why don't you take it from the top. Section 1.
Okay. Section 1 is all new, findings and intent. And this language was added so that it was clear to a future court what the intent of the legislature was, and that it conforms to instructions that the court has given that when you begin to infringe upon First Amendment rights, there's a need for a driving state interest. And so we attempted to identify that interest and then to say to indicate that we're narrowly tailoring the restriction to meet that interest. Okay?